Can you all see me? I feel like what Mark Twain said, I'm always embarrassed when people compliment me. I feel they're not saying enough. That was the shortest introduction that I've had in a long time.
I'm usually long-winded.
Before I tell you my name, I'd like to say that I read someplace where it says the intelligence of a group is measured by how easy it is for them to pronounce a foreign name. My name is Ajit. Got a Mensa crowd in here, love it. I want to dispense with the formalities. I want to thank Maurice for inviting me to come to this conference and for the committee for sanctioning it. But I do have one complaint, Maurice. When I come to Al-Anon or AA conferences as the Al-Anon speaker, usually they send a very striking woman to pick me up. You send Zippy. And to add insult to injury, he stood there looking around. I walked right past him. But then I recognized from the sick look on his face, he was an AA speaker, but I mean AA committee member coming to pick me up. And I asked him, I said, how come you did not recognize me? Wasn't I reeking of serenity? And he said, no, I was looking for a turban guy. As I mentioned to my friends in Shepton, and I want to dispel some stereotypes, I have never, ever worn a turban. I don't have a dot on my forehead. I don't have a cobra or a tiger for a pet. I don't wear my golf shoes with the spikes on the insides. But I do want to thank Zippy. He's been a consummate host. He's fed me more than I've eaten, and I realize why he is in the shape he's in. So he's been very, very considerate, very thoughtful, always present. I want to thank you, Zippy. I don't say this to too many men, but I do love you. You're quite a guy. No idea. I want to thank Madeline for hosting you. Madeline, I have a present for you. I brought this all the way from California when they called me and told me that you had a certain passion.
Oh, no.
They pushed me up to it, Madeline. I know, Popeye. That's the other thing. Zippy's wearing a t-shirt and it's got a finger pointing this way. He said, the guy next to me is Popeye. And he and I are walking down the boardwalk and people are giving us other curious looks. Anyway, I also want to thank the other speakers. I've learned a lot of this weekend, as I always do when I go to conferences. God, I did not get to hear the Wednesday night speaker, Ed, but I heard he was wonderful. I'm sure going to get something from his tape. And then I enjoyed David thoroughly. What a delightful message, followed by Bill. And then, of course, my buddy Rick from Toronto. Wow. And then, God, top it off with Sheila. And then tonight we get to hear Marty, which I'm not too sure about. But oh, he's got a great message, too. And I just want to tell you that the name Ajit is, as I mentioned, Indian, not the feathered kind, but the turban kind, although never worn a turban. And it means one who cannot be beaten. My mom must have really had high hopes and expectations of me. And I'm surprised that I have about 99 odd versions to my name, ranging from horseshit to asshit. I don't know why. Most of them from my former mother-in-law. Ashit? How'd you come up with horseshit from a jeep, you know? I grew up in Bombay, India. I left the shores of Bombay at the age of 22 with no knowledge of this disease called alcoholism, and that's kind of ironic because we lost an uncle to that disease. He died of cirrhosis of the liver, blind in both eyes, totally alone. I was told that his wife literally dropped him off an almost stopped car outside another uncle's home. I thought maybe she was practicing detachment. I realized it wasn't detachment, it was geographic distancing. Out of sight, out of mind, and my uncle died literally alone. So I had no idea what this was all about. despite the fact I came across AA in my sixth standard, and we call them standards there, you call them grades here, and I recall my vice principal, my headmaster, had started the first chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous in Bombay, India. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, what the hell is Alcoholics Anonymous all about? And he said, oh, they get drunks off the street and get them sober. Little did I realize that at least figuratively, AA would come to lift my now former spouse up and get her sober. Now, I'll tell you in a quick second my problem, my disease. I cannot recall when exactly I walked into AA, into Al-Anon. It was circa 1980. But I know exactly when she walked into AA. May 25th, 1983, 8.02 p.m. at the University United Methodist Church in Irvine, California. And my other problem is image management. A bunch of you nod on that. Image management states that I may feel like shit, but I gotta look good. And I look even better if the person next to me portrays a certain image that tells other people around who don't really care a hoot about me, but I think they are, that I'm okay. And that's been the bane of my existence for the longest time. See, I fought with the word disease. I did not like the word disease being applied to me, a non-alcoholic, until I was in an Al-Anon meeting and a woman said something that clicked with me. She said, disease is dis-ease, the insides not matching the outsides. That I could understand, because it's been a big, big problem for me, a big trip for me, if you will, to bring the two into connection with each other. And I'm still kind of it's progress, not perfection, as they say. But before I go any further, I do want to welcome the Al-Anons. I'm sure virtually every Al-Anon is attending this meeting. Welcome. I see a bunch of AAs in this room. I welcome you. Some of you, I really welcome. But anyway, I finished up with my education in India, my undergraduate work, and I climbed the proverbial mountain. And I was telling Zippy, I wore my best Sunday loincloth, star-studded. And I walked up the mountain to my guru, and I said, oh, great one, I seek serenity. He said, go to Detroit, Michigan, and join Al-Anon. The bastard neglected to tell me I had to marry an alcoholic in the process. And you know, I was thinking today, so what the hell am I going to talk about? I have no idea. So a voice said, why don't you just keep it simple and say how it was, what happened, and how it is today. And so that's exactly what I'm going to do. So the first part of what I tell you is really static. It's not changed unless I lie really well and embellish it somehow, which I'm doing every now and then. It's progress. I'm still sick. And some of you heard my story, not surprise my friends from Chesterton, Renee and Jewel and a bunch of other people. I'm so happy to see you. I saw a lady, Caroline, from Pennsylvania. God, that's wonderful to see some people that I've run into in the past. But anyway, I come out of Detroit, Michigan, well warned by fans and family. They said, do not get involved with American women. Canadians are okay, Lise. I said, why is that? They say, oh, they drink and smoke in the open like men. Translation, Indian women, at least the discreet ones, do it behind closed doors. I come out of the States. Now, the fact that the American woman smoked was not an issue, but I loved the fact that she drank. I like Alan Alda's comment in MASH. He said, my kind of woman, drunk. Since their candy is dandy, but liquor's quicker, it made my progress in an evening extremely cost-effective and expedient. It was fun. Little did I realize it would cost me. I was gathering karmic debt. God. I remember working on my graduate work, doing my graduate work at a university called Wayne State in the middle of Detroit, in the heart of Detroit. And then I finished up and I was living in the suburbs in Troy, Michigan. And I used to hang around a meat market called Yesterday's. And I used to invite these women to, you know, best thing to do is create some sense of adventure by inviting them to downtown Detroit, where no sane person would go after 7 o'clock, because even the muggers were mugging each other. But we used to go to Greek Town, which was policed by the Greek Mafia, and you were very safe. And the reason I liked to go to Greek Town is because in those days, and I'm somewhat dating myself, but what the hey, I'm 49, Back in the 70s, you could get a four-course meal, which included a bottle of Rodetis wine for about $25. And the thing about Rodetis wine was, it would transform an absolute stranger into the best of friends over one evening. You'd go from dinner to my place, and it was wonderful. And I, you know, when I married my wife, I said, God, I dated a bunch of these women, and I did not get into a relationship, or I did not marry them. Relationship was just a stretching the word to its ultimate. Maybe a week or two is what it lasted. And I'd say, you know, we Al-Anons carry a beam. Alcoholic, no, don't waste your time. Alcoholic, no, she doesn't need taking care of. She's not meant to be with you because she's not going to give meaning to your life. Move on, move on, move on. And I said, I met you, my beam took off, and here I am taking care of you. And she said, nonsense, if you'd married one of them, you would have driven them to drink too, like you did me. They say, never get into a boxing match with an alcoholic, you come out bruised. You know, I don't like this difference we create between alcoholics and Al-Anons in so many ways. I think when I share at a meeting, I have sometimes a bunch of men in AA come and say, Jesus, I felt quite a bit like the way you did. Maybe we need Al-Anon. And when I first started Al-Anon, I used to go to open AA speaker meetings, and I'd identify with the speaker except for the drinking part. And I'd tell my wife, you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, no, don't even come near us. And I said, but I totally identify with this guy. She said, the feelings, not the drinking. And I come to recognize, and the friends of mine in Al-Anon said, they are self-centered. And I said, now why did you want them to get sober? Because it would straighten out my life, as Rick was talking about yesterday. I said, isn't that self-centered thinking too? I really did not care if she would stop drinking. I just wanted to stop drinking so my life would be okay. And as my story progresses, you'll see that. Anyway, my serenity, desire for serenity, drove me into this place called Traffic Jam one evening. And Traffic Jam was a student hangout. I was a part-time lecturer, and I'd take my students to this place for a couple of beers after class. And here comes this woman who's working her way through nursing school to wait on this table. And my beam took off, you know, met the woman I'm going to take care of, make excuses for, pay her bills, blah, blah, blah. Greg, you can't leave. And her beam took off and met the idiot who's going to make my excuses, tell my lies, mend my relationships, count my drinks, blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, I ask her out. And she tells me, and my ego lets me believe this, that she had never ever been out with anyone from that establishment, a patron that is. And I was the first one. God, I stood about 6'10". And we went out. Now see, there were strange things coming my way. My God's a God who has a sense of humor and has a God of irony, because messages are coming at me, but I was ignoring them. We went out to, I invited her to a party. And I talked about image management. This was a party being put on by my boss at the time. I worked for Xerox. And the woman I was seeing at the time did not meet the image, or have the image that I wanted to display at this party. Now certain people think, boy, what a cad. I used to be a cad. I'm less of a cad today. So instead of taking that woman in, I'm waiting at this restaurant, this bar, and this woman's beam takes off, and I look at her, and she fits the image I want to project, and I ask her out, and she says yes. And before the party, we go out to dinner. Now normally when I went to dinner, I'd listen with an open mind, in one ear, out the other, because I was strategizing. Well, with this woman, I was actually indulging in intellectual intercourse. She was talking and I was listening, and it was over 3 hours. It's scary. I should have left her in the restaurant, gotten my car, driven away, but no, I was going to seek serenity, even if it killed me. So we went out to the party, and my buddy George shows up. He says, oh, you and Susan look so comfortable together. How long have you been seeing each other? 6-7 years. I said, George, I met this woman last week. This is our first date. He says, no, you look too damned comfortable. Something is not right. He was right. I should have left her the party, gotten my car, driven away, but no, we were going to see each other. It was about 4 months in our relationship. There was a knock on the door. And as I opened the door, this woman stood with a lump on her head. And I said, what happened? She said, my mother hit me in an alcoholic rage. Now the father in me, the knight in shining armor, I mean personalities that Sybil and Roseanne would have fought over, came gushing forward. I said, you will not move in with that woman, you will move in with me. Now a Hindu from Bombay, India does not ask a Polish Catholic girl to move in with her. But that was not the scary part. The scary part was watching her God-fearing Catholic mother, who disavowed sinful living together, actually helping a daughter move in. That should have been a clue. I should have given the key to mother and daughter saying, I surrender. I get in my car, dear God, I don't want serenity. Let me be the cat I am and move on. And that was not all. We lived together in sinful bliss for about a year. Strange things were going on. And I should have had, you know, some knowledge that something was awry. But I wasn't in denial, because you see, to get to denial, you have to have some awareness. When you're clueless, how can you get to denial? And then how do you get to acceptance? And the reason I recognize in retrospect is that you have to have some depth to your personality to have some feeling awareness. You see, I was totally disconnected. I think I have a mild case of, at least in those days, of being slightly sociopathic. If you served a certain purpose in my life, you were welcome. The moment you exhausted that, I had no need for you. I did not care about your feelings. I didn't care. I pretended to at times. I had no depth, emotional connection to you. There's certain people, or someone sharing, or someone died, and they get so touched by it. The pet dies, or relative dies. I really did not affect me in that way. I was totally disconnected. And as a matter of fact, it was in my men's tag Al-Anon group, and all these men were talking about feelings and love and all that good stuff. And I said, God, this Al-Anon is going to bring out this feeling side in me, and perhaps that's good. And one day I'm driving and I'm drinking a soda, and all of a sudden I feel a welling up in my chest. I said, I'm experiencing a feeling, but what is this feeling? I'm not happy. I'm not sad. Things are okay, and all of a sudden there's a carbon oxide or whatever it is escapes from me, and I say, oh Lord, it wasn't a feeling, it was just gas. I mean, that's how disconnected I was from myself. How the hell am I going to see what's going on with this woman? I mean, she was minding her own business, doing what she was doing. Occasionally she'd make a mess, you know, and create a noise, and that irritated me because it was affecting my image. But it wasn't bad enough, so we got married. And here, something started. I guess I really did drive her to drink. And I'm still waiting for her to come and say, Ajit, I'm so grateful you drove me to drink, because I found AA and I'm a much better person than I was. But she hasn't done that yet. Anyway, here, this is for the newcomer. I mean, if you guys have been through, and I'm not going to give you her drunk a lot, but I'm giving you my portion of the insanity. I started noticing strange things in the house. For instance, I would go into this little half bathroom we had in this little condo we bought in Warren, Michigan. And I would open up this little cabinet, and 6 or 7 empty cans of beer would topple out. I would go like an idiot to my wife and say, sweetheart, what were those empty cans of beer doing? They were not even in the trash can. That was what I was concerned about. Why weren't they in the trash? And she'd say, Aunt Bunny came over and had a few beers. I never ever picked up the phone and called Aunt Bunny and said, why do you take a six-pack into the bathroom? Are you eliminating the middleman, for instance? They're just pouring it down. Or a buddy of mine would come and say, Tom, would you like a glass of wine? And I want some alcoholic who's been in the program for a long time and might know something about this to please clue me in, because I still don't know how she did it. Tom would say, sure, I'll have a glass of wine. I'd reach into the cabinet, pull out this bottle. I swear to you, there's a cork on it, there's a seal on it, it's got this little red ring on it, but it's empty. Do you sell long syringes? Some alcoholic shop, like they have those dope shops, you get the papers and the scales and all that. They have a special shop for alcohol, so it'll give you syringes. You can suck the wine out and pour it in a glass and screw up the other guy. I started noticing a few strange things about this woman. She was starting to get loud, sometimes violent, verbally and physically. And I said, you know, I think she's got a drinking problem. So I'd been watching those Schick Schedel commercials. You remember those from the 70s? Where this woman goes up to her husband, she says, sweetheart, you have a drinking problem. He says, darling, you're so right. And they go away to get treated. So I believed what I saw. It's a foreigner, you know, even you were a foreigner at the time. So I walk up to my wife and said, sweetheart, you have a drinking problem. She said, you're an idiot. I don't. So I had to resort to, you know, I did not have plan B in place. Only plan A. I thought she'll say yes, I'll take her to Schick Schedel. So I figured, now this is a disease that I think we men are afflicted by. It's called logic, in my case, pseudo-logic. And it's something I think the women perpetrate on us, this myth that we are logical, to manipulate us. Rise, men, we know we're lied to. So I used to say, okay, if I catch her in the act, then she'll know, I know, and she'll stop drinking. So if you don't have much of a life and a lot of time on your hands, you might consider doing some of the things I did, even though they have no, do not change a thing, but it gives you something to do. I would sit on a couch looking at a blank television set, pretending to do the crossword puzzle. Who in the world uses words like ennui? Five-letter word for boredom. Some of you are experiencing that right now. So I'm writing ennui, E-N-N-U-I, and I'm looking at the reflection. And I see her reach under the cabinet and pour some booze. And I make this Archimedean exclamation, aha! Like I've discovered a new law in physics. She was doing what a good alcoholic does. By the way, why do we call them active alcoholics? There was nothing active about her. She was sedentary. Yeah, she sat on the couch and the only activity she had was throwing stuff at me. And then I saw her once on a bicycle in about 10 feet of snow in Chicago, going to the grocery store to pick up some booze. That's about the level of activity. But while she was in the midst of a disease, I'd see her pour booze and then she'd put the bottle away, and then she'd crawl upstairs to the bedroom with some semblance of dignity. And then I'd follow her an hour or so later, making sure she was passed out. And then 2 o'clock, we'd both wake up for feet time. And then she'd get downstairs to move her booze around to pour it. I would first move all the bottles around before I went up, thinking that she'll come down, not find the bottles, know that I knew, and she'd stop drinking. And I hear this clink clang going on, and I'd say, aha, now she knows. I did not know that good alcoholics hide their booze in about 16,000 places. So if they can't place one, it's in place two. I don't know why searching through garbage cans became so important. You walk home, this woman is passed out on the floor, there's stuff coming out of her mouth, it reeks of alcohol. Even a 6-month-old child would speak up and say, that's booze. But I have this compulsion to go up to the garbage can and go through the litter inside and critique her choice of alcohol. Screwtop bottle of wine, how gauche, she didn't let it breathe. Kmart champagne, how can you get so low? And I told this to my sponsor, I said, God darn, I'm being a garbologist, I'm going through garbage cans. And I guess they sent sponsors to one-upmanship school. He said, oh, that's nothing. I said, how could that be nothing? He said, I was in the army, and I would work on jeeps in the middle of the night with a flashlight in my mouth so my hands would be free. And he said, that skill came in real handy. I could go through 2 garbage cans in the middle of the night. I said, God, I'm not going to tell you they sell that helmet at Granger's with a flashlight. Can really go through a mid. Man, it was embarrassing. You know, they say you can spot an alcoholic from the behavior of the person next to them. We'd go out to a dinner with friends, and I'd look at it and say, get all upset. And my friends would look at me and say, Jean, what's wrong with you? I say, she's got pepperoni dripping down her chin. She's got mozzarella on her eyelids. And you're asking me what my problem is? She said, oh, she's having a great time. And she was. You know, alcoholics have a t-shirt say, I drink, I get drunk, I pass out, no problem. Problem's right here. Honey, I haven't had a drink. Really, let me kiss and smell. I'd go, are you done the kiss and sniff test? Oh God, I got buzzed more than she did, just sniffing and kissing. Nothing was working. She would not stop drinking. Life was getting unbearable. And I said, you know what, I'm going to leave. No kids, we had a house, assets were not that high, we could cut loose and move. And I don't know when she developed this fatal attraction to me, she said, if you leave, I will commit suicide. I said, that I want to watch so you don't botch it up. So as I follow her from the doorway where I was about to take off with my little polka dotted thing on a stick, my cloth, felt like Elmer Fudd, or Porky Pig. As I go into the kitchen, her intention changed from suicide to homicide. And I have these knives and dishes flying at me about 95 miles an hour. And this idiot, this image management idiot, is dodging these dishes because I don't want my neighbors to find out that I have a drunk in my home. And that brings me to the next question. Why do alcoholics get anonymous after they get sober? Just bloody drink anonymously in some dark, dank room. I don't give a hoot. I'm teasing. God, it makes your life miserable when you drink and you act up and everyone has to, as Dick was talking about, everyone in the neighborhood has to see Dad running down the street. Why can't Dad just sit in a corner, get drunk? No problem. That's called self-centered thinking on the Al-Anon's part. It was incredible. So nothing was working. I could not leave because she had this fatal attraction to me. She would kill me if I left. So I came up with my next solution. Homicide on my part, I'd kill her. I was reading this magazine called Argosy. It's written by, there's a story by Alfred Hitchcock, and it described the perfect murder weapon. Oh, Greg's coming up here. Thank you, Greg.
I need to make an announcement.
Please.
If somebody in here has a black vehicle with a dog, you have to go to the parking lot. The police will buy your vehicle. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Not a problem. So I was reading this magazine, and in it, it described the perfect murder weapon. The lady in the black dress is paying a lot of attention all of a sudden. You're listening, aren't you? And you have them in Baltimore. It's called an icicle. It disappears. It's the middle of February. I said, I'll take this icicle, I'll kill her. The icicle disappears. No murder weapon. A one-armed bearded man did it, officer. And I'll go look for him on the golf course in Florida. Not getting political, just kidding. And I figured I'd dig up the basement. All this is happening in nanoseconds, right? Now, this is a kid who comes from the land of Gandhi, right? You do not kill someone. You simply starve yourself to death in front of them. So, geez, please don't starve. I'm leaving. I was listening to a comedian who said, Gandhi were in Italy, India would still be under the influence of the British. Okay. Chicken parmesan, are you kidding me? I'm not starving. Yeah, bring it here. So I said, I'll dig up the basement, I'll pour a body, I'll pour fresh cement. I know nothing about masonry, but who cares? Details. And life will be wonderful. But what stopped me was not the fact that it was a heinous crime that I was going to take someone's life. What stopped me was my mother-in-law, or my fear of my mother-in-law. She lived about 3 miles away. I figured she'd find dust on my wife's company car, and she'd call the police. And I realized that I did not come out of the United States to befriend some guy named Bubba in a Michigan prison. That was not the goal. I was so guilty about that. I was sharing that in my meeting on a Friday evening at the Irvine. And a lady said to me, she said, I'm so glad you shared. And I said, why? She said, oh God, I've been guilty, feeling guilty about this. I too wanted to kill my husband. I said, what happened? She said, he was lying on the couch and there was a pillow. He was fast asleep. I was going to take the pillow and snuff him out. I said, why did you not do it? Thinking she'll say, God, that's taking someone's life. That's not right. It's immoral. It's blah, blah, blah. Instead, she said, oh, they would have found cotton in his nose. And they would have known him. Call that self-centered thinking? I do. Finally, the twins came to my rescue. I'm not talking about the Norwegian ski team. I'm talking about dear landlanders and dear Anlanders and dear Abby. I'm a man of the 90s and the 2000s. I read them. And there was a big man in the Detroit Free Press that said, I'm a mother of child, a father of whatever of an alcoholic, go to Al-Anon. Said, finally, someone is going to tell me how to get this woman sober. So I strode into my first Al-Anon meeting. I did not crawl under the belly of a snake, under the door, or any of that stuff. I walked in real hard, looked into the room, and as someone said yesterday, it's a disease of perception. The room was brightly lit as there's beautiful people in there, but to me, the room was dark and dank, and there were 6 women in there, average age deceased. So, that was my impression, 6 dead women, and I said, oh my God. I walked up to the deadest one of them and I said, and they were about as old as I am now. I walked up to the deadest of them all. She had a few more cobwebs on her skeleton. I said, how does this thing work? And she was scared. She did not want to talk to me. She pointed me to the literature table. She said, "You will go there. There's a pamphlet." She wouldn't even walk up to the table with me. And she said, "The pamphlet, it says 12 steps. You pick that up and you read it." And that's how it works. So in my naivete, in my stupidity, I'm thinking, there's an escape clause at the top. It says, these steps are taken from Alcoholics Anonymous. We change one word in the 12th step. We call it others. Instead of saying we take it to the alcoholic, we take it to others. So I figured some steps apply to me, some don't. I'll go through these steps right now. Step 13, she gets sober. Now I know what step 13 is, but I didn't know at the time. So I read the first one. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I said, I'm not powerless over alcohol. I drink to my limit, which is one drink shy of this intense desire to wear a lampshade and be the life of the party and embarrass people. And my life isn't unmanageable. Talk about denial. God. You know, I was using my wife's drinking for every damned excuse. I'd started a new job and my boss said, "How's, we had such high hopes for you. What's happening? You're not working out. You're not producing the results." Oh, my wife drinks too much. People stop me in the street and say, "What time is it?" "What? My wife drinks too much." "What's wrong with you?" "What? My wife drinks too much." And nothing was, I was isolating myself from my friends and family. I did not want to talk to anyone because I was so damned embarrassed by what was going on, by the fact that they would snicker every time they saw my spouse getting soused. And I wasn't, my life wasn't certainly unmanageable, so move on. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I said, "I'm the sane one, she's the insane one. What am I doing reading this?" Move on. Step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I said, 12 years of Catholic school told me that God helps those who help themselves. Why give back to God that which He's given to me? That would make God an Indian giver. Only I can say that. Step four, took a searching and fearless moral inventory. I was perfect. I said, "I'm living with this drunk. She won't let me leave and I'm doing the right thing." Move on. Admitted to God, to myself, and to another human being. That step goes against the credo of image management. First, there was nothing wrong. If there was something wrong, God didn't know about it, then what kind of a God was that? And if there was something wrong, you certainly were not going to find out about it. That's crazy. Move on. Step six and seven, nothing to be removed. No humility in the play here. Actually, I was so humble, I was proud of it, so I moved on. Step eight, made a list of persons I'd harmed. I said, if I harmed them, they deserved it. Step 9, made direct amends. I was still waiting for her to make amends to me. It did not apply to me. Move on. Step 10, my head was really hurting by now because the halo was fitting too tight. It's been bad, I tell you. I have been stuck in this damn program. It's been stuck in this 95 inches right here. I'm exaggerating. It's only 8 inches. And it's taken close to 18 or 19 years to start seeping down here because I was living in a state of conceptualization. I was living in a state of thought and analysis and philosophizing and all that sort of good stuff. And as my story will reveal to you, it's a very difficult process to then finally come to and get your feet firmly on the ground, come face to face with matching the insides with the outsides. Because I don't have alcoholism in my life directly today. My former spouse now is sober almost 18 plus years. I don't have any drinking in my home. I have kids who don't, at least to date, have not used and abused any kind of substance. I have 16-year-old twins and two after that, 14 and 10, and I have not seen anything. So I'm not directly affected by alcoholism. And people ask me, why do you still go to Al-Anon? I say, I don't even use the word qualifier for the alcoholic. I hear my friends in Al-Anon say, oh, my qualifier is my husband, or my qualifier is my daughter, or my qualifier is... My qualifier is right here between my ears, because this has what has created the biggest illusion for me in terms of my perception of the world. And that's what Al-Anon is showing me, but not in that room. That room, I was trying to find out, if only if I can get her sober. See, I didn't know the meaning of the word sobriety. All I wanted her to drink where the way I wanted her to drink, which was two glasses of white wine, specifically Chardonnay. Because when she drank the third glass, she made my life miserable. So I'm reading these steps. I'm reading now the 11th step, you know, sought through prayer and meditation. I did not get to the second half. The first half I said, God, I pray all the time. God, get her killed, 6 Hail Marys. Don't get anyone else killed, 12 Hail Marys. Forget it, God, just bring her back. God said, are you nuts? Ask for a prayer and then stick with it. And I looked at the lady 12 steps later. I was spiritually awakened in 3.5 minutes. I looked at her and said, now what? And she looked at me, she said, keep coming back. I know why Moon Unit Zappa wrote that song. Gag me with a spoon. I said, why? She said, because you're sick. I didn't realize how deceptive that woman was. I said, okay, and I'd go back every 6 weeks. Now I'm embarking on a program that's literally going to get to the core of my psyche. It's going to take that little tool and twist the inside just somewhat so I change my perception of life from victim or martyr to someone who's creating their reality and the choices they make and how they respond to the world. And I'm going to do this, change my outlook by changing, it's going to change my outlook, change my attitudes, change my belief system, change my behavior, change the person I've become or I'm becoming by going to one meeting every 6 weeks and cutting it. And then you got me stuck in this word called disease for the alcoholic. Oh, your wife has a disease like cancer. Or your wife has a disease like diabetes. I would request my friends in Al-Anon not to use that analogy for idiots like me. And you ask the person first. First of all, I want to find out, are you an idiot like a Jeep? If you are, then we don't want to use this analogy. Let's use another analogy. And I'll tell you why. Because my brain starts to break up into about 16,000 fragments with thoughts and anti-thoughts flying, and you've got epsilon thoughts coming out, and they're all screaming at each other. And the first head said, she's got a disease like cancer. Why is she seeking chemotherapy? She's got a disease like diabetes. Seek insulin therapy. No one sentence said, hey, this disease goes beyond the physiological and physical definitions of disease and enters the mental and spiritual and psychological realms of disease, beyond anything you can conceive of. And number two, it really is none of your damn business what it is, because your problem is not the disease part, your problem is your focus on this person. See, I don't recognize that. I figure out, if I figure out that it's a disease, then I'll accept it. Today, if you ask me, do you know if alcoholism is a disease for sure? I'll say, I really don't know and I don't care, for two reasons. One, I have no control over it, number one. Number two, I obsess over behavior. I'll go to a restaurant with a beautiful woman on a date. She'll be drop-dead gorgeous in every sense of the word, but God forgive her, she's got a piece of lettuce stuck in her tooth. Because I obsess on that. I want to take dental floss and I want to clean it. I want to spray water on it. I want to do something. I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean. I was talking to my wife one day. I said, you alcoholics, you give up booze, then you are focused, you're obsessed with cigarettes. You give that up, then you're obsessed with exercise. You give that up and you're obsessed with sweets and something. And she said, isn't that interesting? Your obsession has moved right along and you're observing it. See, that's my problem. My problem is not the effects of disease, and that's what I was stuck on for the longest bloody time. I even took my wife, and people said, you know, take her to marriage therapy. Maybe that'll help. So I take her to marriage therapy, right? I call this guy up. I educate him for half an hour on the phone. I said, I'll bring this woman in. You take one look at her, and you say, you're an alcoholic. And you strap her to some bedpost someplace and put whatever stuff you put down her gullet and get her sober. He knew he was talking to an idiot. So I dragged my wife to the marriage counselor, and I guess he hadn't heard a word of what I'd said. He said, so, what's the problem? You don't ever ask a guy what, because my brain shuts off, my reflexes take over. So my wife drinks too much. So he starts to take notes, to make a long story short. She's crying, he's writing, I'm standing there totally dumbfounded, because plan did not work out. She said, I'll find a marriage counselor. She did. We go to see this guy. He'd been to school with the first guy, because he asked the same question. So, what's the problem? Like, you know, they're going to solve the problems of the world by ponderously looking at you. So, what's the problem? Said, my wife drinks too much. He said, so, what's the problem? So I figured he had a problem with my accent. So I spoke louder and slower, and I'm doing charades. My wife. Why do we think that people who don't speak a language are stupid and deaf? I screamed at them. Maybe Lola could have gone with me and made signs to the guy. So now he says again, so what's the problem? And this time I hear, meaning, what's the problem with that? And I looked at this guy and I swear to you, his nose was so red, he could have served as a beacon on a dark ocean guiding ships. I look at my wife and said, oh my God, he's one of you. And she said, no, he understands. See, I tried everything. I tried homicide. I tried, or at least thought about it. I started Al-Anon and still wasn't working. I was still fixated on taking care of this problem that was creating a problem for me. It was embarrassing me. It was isolating me. It was. See, I wasn't the actor. It was being caused upon me, and I was simply reacting to the situation. And yet, I was the same one. Yet, my life was manageable. But my focus was still on this other person. The final straw came is that as I give up, nothing is working. So the Al-Anon thing, and I'm conceptually getting into this Al-Anon thing, and I'm going to one meeting every 6 weeks. Finally, someone said, treatment center. Your company has insurance policy. They'll send her off to Hazleton. So I pack her up and I send her off to Hazleton. I'm not casting aspersions on treatment centers. They have their place. But I know from personal experience that when you force someone to go someplace, it does not seem to work. The seed may be planted. There's always a blessing. And what the blessing was that I was transferred from Detroit to the Chicago area. And I'm not suggesting that you do this in Al-Anon meetings. I got beat up in Arizona for mentioning this. I'm just telling you my experience. In my meeting in Schaumburg, Illinois, in an Al-Anon meeting, when I brought up this disease thing, they looked at me and they said, why don't you go to the source for this understanding of this disease called alcoholism? And it's on the literature table. It's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, finally, someone will show me what this damn thing is all about. So I'm starting to read, and all of a sudden, this disease thing makes total sense. That this person can have one drink or 16,000 drinks, climb up a flight of stairs, come down, crack her ribs, 6 weeks later, do the same damn thing over again as if it had never happened before. And this disease was so powerful. I love what Don from Los Angeles, he's dead now, or Hugh, sorry, would say, that alcoholism is like making love to a gorilla. You ain't done with it till the gorilla is done with it. And it's a very stark representation of this disease. And this gorilla was having a party with my wife. And not only could I not be jealous, I could pry this ugly animal off her. I just had to sit by. But they taught me something called detachment in my meetings and in Hazleton when I went for family week. And they put it in words that made sense to me. They said, detachment is being responsible, is understanding the difference between being responsible to but not being responsible for. See, what happened is, and this came very clearly to me, I was returning from a business trip in Minneapolis to Detroit, to Chicago, and my wife was supposed to pick me up at the airport. And she had a couple, I guess, as they say, only had a couple. And she was driving down, and she slid off the road onto the gravel, the shoulder. And the Chicago cops stopped by, and they did not take too kindly to the fact that she got into a fight with them. So they banged her on the head with a flashlight and took her to jail. So I come home, I take a cab, I get a phone call. I'm in jail, bail me out. I said, I am detached. And I hung up. They taught me in my meeting, said, don't create the fall, but if it happens, don't prevent it from happening. Let them suffer the consequences of their actions. I said, I love this, I am detached. So I go to my meeting, and my friends look at me and say, God, you got this Cheshire smile on your face, what's going on? I said, I am detached. I said, what are you talking about? They said, my wife's in jail. I refuse to bail her out. They said, go bail her out, because if you don't, they'll send her to Cook County Jail, and you do not want to send your worst enemy. See, now I come to recognize that detachment is not an action of anger. It's not an action of separation. It's an act of love and allowing people to be responsible for themselves. And this is how I learned this. I go bail her out, and I use the weapon that I used many times on my wife, and I've since made amends for that, sarcasm. I wasn't a violent man. I never hit my spouse except to push her away when she was being violent. Because I was taught never ever strike a woman. And so I did not want to strike her ever, but I struck her harder with my tongue at the command of the language, and I could just tear her up one side to the other. I learned from my One Day at a Time book the definition of the word sarcasm. It's taken from the Greek word sarcasm, which is to tear flesh. And I was indulging in cannibalism of the worst kind. I was tearing this woman one side the other, and God, I tore her up that morning. How dare she bring me to this jail to bail her out? What did she not think of my image? How do I come into a prison to do this? Blah, blah, blah. But something had started to take root, because she said, would you find me an attorney? I said, I'm responsible to you. I'll pay for the attorney, but I'm not responsible for you. You find your own attorney. So would you go to prison, to the courthouse with me? I said, I'll drop you off because I'm responsible to you. You do not have a car. I will not be there in front of the judge with you because you're responsible for your actions. I was simply mouthing this. The insides were saying, geez, go plead her case for her. Don't even let her go there. You go on your own and talk to the judge and explain to him. But I was doing this despite the fact my insides are screaming at me to do what I normally would do, which is take care of you. So here I'm going. My wife later on let me read a diary. She thought it was the beginning of the end, that I was moving away. I wasn't physically moving away. I was emotionally distancing myself from this crazy disease and allowing her to come face to face with her own. I was going to 3 meetings a week now instead of 1 meeting every 6 weeks. But I was still caught up here. Because we read a lot of literature. We discussed the steps. I wasn't taking any action. I wasn't doing a fourth. I wasn't doing any of that stuff. And now it's transferred to California, and this is where she found her AA, May 25th, 1983. We'd moved that 1 week before that, and she stopped drinking the Monday before that Friday, and that Friday she went into a first meeting and has been going ever since. Did my situation change? No. I waited for the longest time for that moment that she would stop drinking and everything would be hunky-dory. My obsession stayed with me. I started to obsess on what my wife ate, because she also suffered from bulimia. So instead of the sound of opening cans, I was listening to the sound of flushing cans. I started to obsess over her attire. I never ever checked out what my wife was wearing. I was wanting to see what she was dressed in. And the worst of all was her spending. My wife thought that shopping was a religious experience, and she went to a lot of institutions where she could give away my hard-earned money, I thought. And I walked up to my sponsor and said, "What gives?" He says, "The same disease, Ajit. They're obsessed or addicted to substance. You're obsessed or addicted to people and behavior. I'm like a food addict. I have to know how to live with people responsibly without taking them over. I'm the kind of guy, unfortunately, who's on the freeway. I want to drive 4 cars at the same time. The idiot in front of me is not going fast enough. The moron behind me wants to ride in my backseat because he's tailing me so closely. And the guy in my blind spot who won't let me cut in front of the guy in front of me, all of us going at 200 miles an hour. And then I wonder why my life is unmanageable." It's that realization. But here I'm working the steps now. I'm working step 1 and step 2 and step 3, and I've taken the step 4, the 4 column thing. In retrospect, I recognized that it was all up here. It wasn't happening here. And it came to me in about my 8th or 9th year. I've heard some of my other friends in Al-Anon say called hitting the 10-year wall. My business was going to, I'd started a new business. My wife was sober 2 years, and we had wonderful twins given to us, immaculately conceived. Star appears in the east every time it happens. Every birthday they have a star, I'm teasing. And 18 months later, Corey showed up, and today my twins are 16, boy and a girl, and a 14-year-old and a wonderful 10-year-old. All, "Hey, how did that happen?" was a question every time it happened. I finally figured out, and I'm taken care of. They don't look like the mailman or the milkman, so I presume they're mine. But here I was doing this thing, and I started a new business. We bought a new home in California, in a sticker shop coming from Chicago. And something is going crazy. I'm starting to, some months, pay my mortgage with my credit card because my business that flourished for the first year took a dive. I was blaming my partners instead of looking at the choices I had made. I got on my knees and I reached into my wife's bookshelf in the bedroom and I closed my eyes, whatever, because she had a bunch of spiritual books. I grab a book and I pull it out and it turns out to be the Big Book of AA. And I closed my eyes again and said, "God, give me some direction." I open the book to a page and the third step shows up. It says, and it's almost someone who's screaming at me, "You haven't surrendered, you still simply submitted. You're still trying to manipulate the outcome instead of letting go. Instead of being in the process, you're still trying to create something happen for you from the outside." And I walked up to my sponsor, I said, "I'm dropping out of Al-Anon." He said, "Why?" I said, "I've been talking the talk, but I haven't walked the walk. I still do things that are not kosher, I mean, quote unquote, practicing the principles on all my affairs. I sponsor people and I help them, but I'm not doing anything for myself internally. I'm lying all the way through, not necessarily recognizing it consciously, but if I look at the outcome of what's going on, I really haven't been working the program." And you know, I was hitting 3-4 meetings a week. I was the only thing I found towards the latter part of those 10 years in the meetings, that the only profound thing I heard in those meetings was that which was coming out of my mouth. That's a scary place. That's complacency to its max. And I didn't know what the hell was going on. And my sponsor, like Rick was talking about yesterday, said something to me. For the first time in my life, I looked at someone and said, please help me. He said, Ajit, if you hadn't been working the program, you would not have come to this realization. I don't know how he arrived at that logic, but he did, and I'm glad he did. I said, for the first time, I said, help me. He said, this is what I would do. I said, what would you do, Dean? And he never gives me directions. He always makes very subtle suggestions. And I like it that way in the relationship that we have. He looked at me, he says, don't stand up and say that you're powerless over people, places, and institutions unless you specifically mean that for a specific thing. I said, how does that work? He said, I would read about the first step every which way. The book, little book, green book, brown book, black book, whatever book you have, read the first step and then apply it to your situation and exactly what that means. And what he taught me about the first step was it identifies the problem. It really clears up your perceptions because you're using your sponsor on the first step, powerless over. Are you really powerless over? Have you taken these steps to come to effect the change you want to effect? And when you come to that bottom line, you said, this is the problem, then you've identified the problem. And so I was reading my One Day at a Time book. Now, this is where my mind is, and I'll show you how silly or crazy it is. I'm reading my One Day at a Time book. It says, step one is admitting the existence of a reality. So I'm driving and I'm thinking, admitting the existence of a reality, meaning a perceived reality as I perceive it. And my mind says, yes, that's true. And then my mind asked another question. It says, if it's based on your perceptions, is your reality really your reality if your perceptions are off? I said, oh my God. In other words, whatever I'm looking at could be a major illusion if my perceptions are off. So I said, this is scary thinking. I better call my sponsor. 911. My head's doing a trip on me, God. Dean, I need to meet with you. So this is what he helped me with. He says, okay, it's clearly identifying the problem. You've discussed it with your sponsor to see if actually that's your problem. I like what Babs from Texas says. She says, every time I get my ducks in a row, they tell me they're not my ducks. So I truly love that because I had to identify that indeed these were my ducks before I started to do something to them. Then he took me to step two. He says, step two merely gives you empowerment. I said, how's that? He says, it defines what your options are. Helps you look at the solution. What are your options? Because when I'm focused on the problem, I'm fixated on the problem and the problem keeps magnifying because I'm putting all my energy into the problem. But when I've identified the problem, I'm moving on to step two. He says, what are your options? That's when it starts to happen. Step three was a big, big struggle, right? I mean, I thought I'm, even now at times, my head plays games on step three. Because step three says, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. It does not go on to say how that is affected. It does not sit and define the steps I take to release myself. It's simply a statement saying, God, I turn it over to you. But how do I know what's God's will and what's not my will? And how does that all that intermingle? I've come to recognize for myself that's irrelevant if I don't get caught up in the solution. If I accept that which turns out when I put my best foot forward and I've given it my best. And that's where I even get in trouble. Is my best enough? And I'm laying out what really is going on with me in terms of my struggle with my program, saying, okay, am I really giving it my best? Because somewhere down there's a little boy who was told by his parents, if you want to reach for the top of the tree, aim for the stars, which means you'll never get to the top of the tree because you're constantly trying to get to the stars. So I have to reconcile that thinking with saying, you really have given it your best, now surrender the outcome and let go and move on to step four. And see, step four, I hadn't really done a decent step four because I had not taken an in-depth look at who I am, and this is where the miracle comes in on step four for me. My wife realized 8 years into her sobriety that she had been molested as a child. I tell you, if any of you in the room that have gone through that or have spouses that are going through that, my heart goes out to you because it really changed the situation. And this is where the program has shown me that a crisis really is a blessing in disguise. Does that mean that a blessing is a crisis in disguise happening? I don't know. But crisis is a blessing, and I'll tell you what the blessing is. My wife and my relationship changed significantly. It went from a place where there was good intimate physical intimacy and intellectual intimacy and all that good stuff to virtually zero intimacy over a period of 7 years. She could not bear for me to touch her. Then we could just talk and have a wonderful close relationship that way, and that started to disappear. And the last 2 years we were sleeping in separate rooms. Mind you that we are working the program that we were working. We're actually counseling. This is the irony. We're actually counseling other couples in the program on their marriages while our bloody marriage was dying. Because, see, we were under the illusion that because we were going to therapy once a week or once a month on this molestation issue, we're reconnecting and things will be wonderful. And then she dropped the bomb on me in April of 96, and she said, this marriage is over. God, I channeled an old 75-year-old Jewish guy. Said, oh, yeah, I was married to you for 17 years. Put up with your shit, now you're leaving. And OJ showed up and I got a cleaver going and rage, just all the pent-up emotional skunk that came out, screaming, yelling, throwing stuff around, all because of a misperception. See, I had wanted the divorce myself, but noblesse oblige, how can I leave my kids? How can this happen? I will put up with this. You know, someone should have said, get off that damned cross, we need it for firewood. I said, and this is where my sponsor's thinking comes into play. What's the problem? I'm sitting across this attorney, paying this guy $250 an hour to this barracuda to do damage to my wife of the kind that she has never, ever experienced before. I was going to prove to the world that she was psychotic, neurotic, insane, incapable of owning a home or being a parent to my children, and that she ought to be behind bars for what she's done. She has thrown me out. How could she do that? And as I'm sitting across this attorney making plans and he's wagging his finger at me like I'm a two-year-old, my sponsor's voice shows up on my shoulder. He says, so, what's the problem? He'd been to school with the two therapists. Identify the problem. In my mind, I'm saying the problem is I don't want to lose my kids. How do you know you're going to lose your kids? Develop an attitude to match the facts, you idiot. He didn't say, you idiot. That was my adding to it. And I said, how do I do that? I just call her. I said, so I simply just pick up the phone and call her and ask her. He said, isn't that the simple approach? I said, all right. So I look at the attorney. I said, you know what? I got to rethink this. He said, you're going to reconcile? I said, perhaps. I get in the car. I call my wife on my cell. I said, I'm not going to take you to court for one on one condition. She said, what? I said, I do not want to lose custody of my kids. I want to joint parent with you. She said, you're an idiot. We have four kids. I don't want them to myself. All this hassle. Over some, see, I didn't care about the stuff. I didn't care about the house. I didn't care about the assets or any of that stuff. I just did not want to lose connection with my kids. I didn't know that I was so connected to my kids, see? I did not grow up in a family where daddy would come home and put his arms around me and say, son, I love you. It's good for your self-esteem to know that I love you. Let's go play cricket together, son. No, he didn't do any of that stuff. His way of showing love was, make sure you're closing your back, got food in your belly, and you're living in a house. And you don't have to go earn a living at the age of six or prostitute yourself someplace to make a living. Giving you a nice house here, that's my way of showing you love, kid. You know right off the bat it's an understood fact that your father loves you and that you love your father. That's the way it was. I don't think my parents sat up at 3 a.m. to say, how are you going to get up this morning and screw up Ajit's life for the next 24 hours? And see, all this time, I'm thinking this. So anyway, I decided not to take my wife to court. I want to tell you that our divorce was extremely amicable. She signed off. I got a very low alimony thing, and we still work it out. We have a very flexible arrangement with my kids. I call it co-parenting. They come and go as they please. I live very close by, all because of this program. And what this divorce did for me was make me a better father. I actually take my 16-year-old daughter shopping. Her friend said, your dad's going to take you? She said, yeah. I said, Kayla, you can't buy anything unless I get to see it first. And then the plunging neckline goes back into the store. Says, Dad, you want to dress me like Sheila was talking about, the green thing. I love that. That's how my daughter did dress. She said, how old do I have to be to date? I said, 35. She's got a great boyfriend now. She's 16. She said, oh my God, 35. I said, and learn one word. She said, what? I said, no. The guys I know, they think I was one. My therapist warned me. She said, we were in marriage therapy at the time. That didn't work, obviously. And my therapist said, do not get involved. Again, here's a blessing in the making. She said, do not get involved for the first year because you'll come bloody. My mind took over. God, she's talking transition. I transitioned out. 7 years dying, 2 years dead. I'm okay. And I met this beautiful, delightful woman who happened to be from Canada, incidentally. Lived in Irvine, and our eyes met and said, wow, this is it, I'm in love. And I tell you, this woman gave me, in the 1 year that we were together, and right on therapist's predictions, the relationship ended a year later. But this woman gave me everything that I had been missing in the last 7 years of my marriage, and probably a little bit before that. physical, mental, intellectual, spiritual. I mean, I was totally connected to this woman and she with me. But as God would have it, or whatever the reason was, a year later, and I'm sure there's 16,000 reasons depending on who you're talking to, it ended. And I crashed harder than I'd crashed even after my divorce. And I walked up to my sponsor and I almost literally gave him a figurative gun. I said, find a gun and shoot me. He said, why? I said, I'm in excessive pain. I can't take it. As a wise man that he is, he looked at me and he said, so when was the last time you were alone? I said, never. He said, don't you think it's time for you to be alone? I said, what do I do? He said, if I were you, I'd lock yourself up for 2 days and work on page 345 of The Courage to Change. And in that page, on that page, there were four questions that scared the hell out of me. The first question was, who am I? I had no bloody idea. I was like that actor Woody Allen in the movie Zelig, if you haven't seen it. If he's with a bunch of black jazz artists, he becomes a black jazz musician. If he's with a bunch of Hasidic Jews, he becomes a Hasidic Jew. If he's with a bunch of doctors, he becomes a doctor. I mean, anything that he was in the crowd, he blended in. And that's, I had no personal identity in that regard. The second question was, what are my values? I had no idea what my values were. I could talk about them. I could talk about honesty and loyalty and fidelity and all that good stuff. But when I look at my resume, those things had been lacking in my life. I hadn't been loyal to my friendships. I hadn't been faithful in my relationships. I hadn't been honest in all my dealings. I talked about values, but I wasn't putting them into practice. It's like saying you're working a program by going to meetings. Or by doing this, you can stand in a garage for 20 million years, but you're never going to become a car unless you stick a transmission up your you-know-what. I mean, there's no bloody way it's going to happen unless you do some action. So I wasn't doing action. I'm starting to look at this stuff and said, oh my God. I asked my sponsor, I said, how do I know what my values are? I said, do you value your business? I said, yes. He said, how do you show it? Do you value your children? I said, yes. How do you show it? So I got to write all this down. Now, before I got into this, the next question was, what traits of character do I wish to keep about me? And the last one was, what traits of character do I want to get rid of? Step 6 and 7. I start on Thanksgiving on 97 and start writing. I finish up that Friday. Saturday morning, I do my 5th. And I tell you, for the first time, the program is starting to sink in. This is 18 years into when I started Al-Anon. I'm starting to feel like I'm working the program. And that illusion of separation between the inside and the outside is starting to dissolve. The person I'm looking in the mirror, I start to like. I'm crying. I prepared myself for this thing by reading 3 or 4 books. And I normally don't proselytize and tell you what books to read, but if there's one book you haven't read, it's on step 3. It's by Chuck C., A New Pair of Glasses. I'd read that. I'd read another book called Conversations with God, which really resonated with me. I'd read another one by Thomas Merton that says Zen and the Birds of Appetite, which was another one with step 3 stuff. All on surrender, all on letting go. And I'm writing this and I'm cussing my father out, I'm angry at my relatives, I'm angry at my wife, my kids, the whole thing is pouring out. All the junk that was in there, and Darth Vader shows up. Welcome to the dark side. Because see, I'd been in the program. If I got angry, I got angry for being angry. How can I be angry in the program? If I got jealous of someone, how could I be jealous? I'm in program. If I'm insecure, how can I be insecure? I'm in program. I denied the part of me that was in the shadow side because I only wanted to acknowledge that was in the light. I feel spiritual. I can share. Like Rick was talking about yesterday, screaming at the person for playing their shoelaces, but he's talking serenity. The image is intact. And that's who was the lie that was not, that was being revealed all the time in the form of truth. And this is what those 2 days did. Did I get cured after that and develop gossamer wings? No. What has been since then has been an ongoing 4th step, that stuff gets revealed about me. Someone had once said, oh, I don't like a cheat because he's full of himself. And that hurt, because I always thought I was a people person. I was really connected, until I came to recognize I was damned arrogant and I hadn't recognized it. And a veil came off earlier this year. He said, you're an arrogant SOB. You know that. Because what you do is you walk around still judging people. In some way, nice, not nice, good, this, that. That's a tremendous arrogance because I see myself as separate from you when I'm not. The illusion is starting to clear up that I accept people just the way they are. But I cannot do that unless I accept myself. So this program for me has been more of self-acceptance than having to deal with someone else's drinking or someone else's addiction or what have you. Because unless I come to total acceptance on the inside of who I am and match that with the outside, I cannot accept you. Then I'm lying to you by pretending that I like you or that you're okay with me, because you're not, because I'm not okay with me. The program says, let it begin with me, and I'm going to say, let it end with me, because this is where I'm at today. I'm struggling with the steps in the sense that I work at them constantly. I read a book someplace that asked, if you don't know what step you're on, perhaps you're not working the program. I meet with my sponsor on a regular basis. Why? He's no wiser or smarter or more intelligent than I am. He's simply not emotionally involved in my crap, and I perhaps can serve the same purpose to him. In my case, he is wiser and more intelligent than I am, but he doesn't have to be. I go to my meetings now to participate and partake of. I indulge in service. Just because I stand here, I know nothing more than you do. I don't have any experiences that are unique enough to say, geez, you'll never ever experience that, and I have it. The only reason I'm here is because I have the ability to stand in front of a crowd and articulate my story in some fashion that may come across as interesting to perhaps some few people in this room, and that's all that matters. And I'm no brighter or wiser or more spiritually inclined than anyone else, but I have come to this conclusion now, and this is the truth, that I do love every single one of you. I don't know you, but when I walk by you, I'm starting to experience the connection of the Spirit, because as Chuck Seed talked about, when I erase that circle, I become part of the infinity, and that's where I choose to be today. This moment, I don't know if it'll exist for me in the next moment, but this very moment I'm experiencing that, and I'm grateful to you for that. Thank you for letting me share.
Okay.